Chapter 4, Exploring the Brain Attic, The Value of Creativity and Imagination. A young solicitor, John Hector McFarlane, wakes up one morning to find his life upended. Overnight, he has become the single most likely suspect in the murder of a local builder. He barely has time to reach Sherlock Holmes to tell his story before he is swept off to Scotland Yard, so damning is the evidence against him. As he explains to Holmes before he is whisked away, he had first met the victim, a certain Jonas Oldacre, only the prior afternoon. The man had arrived at McFarlane's offices and asked him to copy and witness his will. And to Mr. McFarlane's surprise, that will left him all of the builder's property. He was childless and alone, explained Oldacre, and once upon a time, he had known McFarlane's parents well. He wanted to commemorate the friendship with the inheritance, but, he urged, McFarlane was not to breathe a word of the transaction to his family until the following day. It was to be a surprise. That evening, the builder asked the solicitor to join him for dinner so that they might afterward go over some important documents in connection with the estate. McFarlane obliged, and that, it seems, was that. Until, that is, the following morning's papers described Oldacre's death and the burning of his body in the timber yard at the back of his house. The most likely suspect, young John Hector McFarlane, who not only stood to inherit the dead man's estate, but had also left his walking stick, bloodied, at the scene of the crime. McFarlane is summarily arrested by Inspector Lestrade, leaving Holmes with his strange tale. And though the arrest seems to make sense, the inheritance, the stick, the nighttime visit, all the indications that point to McFarlane's guilt, Holmes can't help but feel that something is off. I know it's all wrong, Holmes tells Watson. I feel it in my bones. Holmes's bones, however, are in this instance going against the preponderance of evidence. As far as Scotland Yard is concerned, the case is as close to airtight as they come. All that remains is to put the final touches on the police report. When Holmes insists that all is not yet clear, Inspector Lestrade begs to differ. Not clear? Well, if that isn't clear, what could be clear? He interjects. Here is a young man who learns suddenly that if a certain older man dies, he will succeed to a fortune. What does he do? He says nothing to anyone, but he arranges that he shall go out on some pretext to see his client that night. He waits until the only other person in the house is in bed, and then in the solitude of a man's room, he murders him, burns his body in the woodpile, and departs to a neighboring hotel. As if that weren't enough, there's more. The bloodstains in the room and also on the stick are very slight. It is probable that he imagined his crime to be a bloodless one, and hoped that if the body were consumed, it would hide all traces of the method of his death, traces which, for some reason, must have pointed to him. Is not all this obvious? Holmes remains unconvinced. He tells the inspector, It strikes me, my good Lestrade, as being just a trifle too obvious. You do not add imagination to your other great qualities, but if you could for one moment put yourself in the place of this young man, would you choose the very night after the will had been made to commit your crime? Would it not seem dangerous to you to make so very close a relation between the two incidents? Again, would you choose an occasion when you are known to be in the house, when a servant has let you in? And finally, would you take the great pains to conceal the body and yet leave your own stick as a sign that you were a criminal? Confess, Lestrade, that all this is very unlikely. But Lestrade just shrugs his shoulders. What does imagination have to do with it? Observation and deduction, sure. These are the linchpins of detective work. But imagination? Isn't that just a flimsy retreat of the less hard-minded and scientific professions, those artistic dalliers who couldn't be further from Scotland Yard? Lestrade doesn't understand just how wrong he is and just how central a role imagination plays, not just to the successful inspector or detective, but to any person who would hold himself as a successful thinker. If he were to listen to Holmes for more than clues as to a suspect's identity or a case's line of inquiry, he would find that he might have less need of turning to him in the future. For if imagination does not enter into the picture, and do so before any deduction takes place, all of those observations, all of that understanding of the prior chapters, will have little value indeed. Imagination is the essential next step of the thought process. It uses the building blocks of all of the observations that you've collected to create the material that can then serve as a solid base for future deduction, be it as to the events of that fateful Norwood evening when Jonas Oldacre met his death, or the solution to a pesky problem that has been gnawing at you at home or at work. If you think that you can skip it, that it is something unscientific and frivolous, you'll find yourself having wasted much effort only to arrive at a conclusion that, as clear and obvious as it may seem to you, could not be further from the truth. What is imagination, and why is it so important? Why, of all things to mention to Lestrade, does Holmes focus on this particular feature? And what is it doing in something as strict-sounding as the scientific method of the mind? Lestrade isn't the first to turn his nose up at the thought of imagination playing a role in good old scientific reason, nor is Holmes alone in his insistence to the contrary. One of the greatest scientific thinkers of the 20th century, Nobel-winning physicist Richard Feynman, frequently voiced his surprise at the lack of appreciation for what he thought was a central quality in both thinking and science. "It is surprising that people do not believe that there is imagination in science," he once told an audience. Not only is that view patently false, but it is a very interesting kind of imagination, unlike that of the artist. The great difficulty is in trying to imagine something that you have never seen, that is consistent in every detail with what has already been seen, and that is different from what has been thought of. Furthermore, it must be definite and not a vague proposition. That is indeed difficult. It's tough to find a better summation and definition of the role of imagination in the scientific process of thought. Imagination takes the stuff of observation and experience and recombines them into something new. In so doing, it sets the stage for deduction, the sifting through of imaginative alternatives to decide. Out of all of the possibilities you've imagined, which is the definite one that best explains all of the facts? In imagining, you bring into being something hypothetical, something that may or may not exist in actuality, but that you have actively created in your own mind. As such, what you imagine is different from what has been thought of. It's not a restatement of the facts, nor is it a simple line from A to B that can be drawn without much thought. It is your own synthesis and creation. Think of imagination as a kind of essential mental space in your attic where you have the freedom to work with various contents, but don't yet have to commit to any storage or organizational system, where you can shift and combine and recombine and mess around at will and not be afraid of disturbing the main attic's order or cleanliness in any way. That space is essential in the sense of there not being a functional attic without it. You can't have a storage space that is filled to the brim with boxes. How would you ever come inside? Where would you pull out the boxes to find what you need? How would you even see what boxes were available and where they might be found? You need space. You need light. You need to be able to access your attic's contents, to walk inside and look around and see what is what. And within that space, there is freedom. You can temporarily place there all of the observations you've gathered. You haven't yet filed them away or placed them in your attic's permanent storage. Instead, you lay them all out where you can see them, and then you play around. What patterns emerge? Can something from permanent storage be added to make a different picture, something that makes sense? You stand in that open space and you examine what you've gathered. You pull out different elements, try out different combinations, see what works and what doesn't, what feels right and what doesn't. And you come away with a creation that is unlike the facts or observations that have fed into it. It has its roots in them, true, but it is its own unique thing, which exists only in that hypothetical state of your mind and may or may not be real or even true. But that creation isn't coming out of the blue. It is grounded in reality. It is drawing upon all those observations you've gathered up to that point. consistent in every detail with what has already been seen. It is, in other words, growing organically out of those contents that you've gathered into your attic through the process of observation, mixed with those ingredients that have always been there, your knowledge base and your understanding of the world. Feynman phrases it thus, imagination in a tight straitjacket. To him, the straitjacket is the laws of physics. To Holmes, it is essentially the same thing. That base of knowledge and observation that you've acquired to the present time. Never is it simply a flight of fancy. You can't think of imagination in this context as identical to the creativity of a fiction writer or an artist. It can't be. First, for the simple reason that it is grounded in the factual reality that you've built up. And second, because it must be definite and not a vague proposition. Your imaginings have to be concrete. They have to be detailed. They don't exist in reality, but their substance must be such that they could theoretically jump from your head straight into the world with little adjustment. Per Feynman, they are in a straitjacket, or in Holmes's terms, they are confined and determined by your unique brain attic. Your imaginings must use it as their base, and they must play by its rules. And those rules include the observations you've so diligently gathered. The game is, continues Feynman, to try to figure out what we know, what's possible. It requires an analysis back, a checking to see whether it fits. It's allowed according to what is known. And in that statement lies the final piece of the definition. Yes, imagination must come from a basis in real, hard knowledge, from the concreteness and specificity of your attic. And yes, it serves a greater purpose. A setup for deduction, be it of scientific truth, a solution to a murder, or a decision or problem in your own life that is far removed from both. And in all these instances, it must deal with certain constraints. But it is also free. It is fun. It is, in other words, a game. It is the most playful part of a serious endeavor. Not for nothing does Holmes utter the famed refrain, "The game is afoot," in the opening lines of The Adventure of the Abbey Grange. That simple phrase conveys not only his passion and excitement, but his approach to the art of detection and, more generally, of thought. It is a serious thing indeed, but it never loses the element of play. That element is necessary. Without it, no serious endeavor stands a chance. We tend to think of creativity as an all-or-nothing, you-have-it-or-you-don't characteristic of the mind. But that couldn't be further from the truth. Creativity can be taught. It is just like another muscle. Attention, self-control, that can be exercised and grow stronger with use, training, focus, and motivation. In fact, studies have shown that creativity is fluid and that training enables people to become more creative. If you think your imagination can grow with practice, you will become better at imaginative pursuits. There, again, is that persistent need for motivation. Believing you can be as creative as the best of them and learning creativity's essential components is crucial to improving your overall ability to think, decide, and act in a way that would more befit a Holmes than a Watson or a Lestrade. Here, we explore that mind space, that stage for synthesis, recombination, and insight. That deceptively lighthearted arena that will allow Holmes to solve the case of the Norwood Builder, for solve it he will. And as you'll see, Lestrade's confidence in the obvious will prove both misguided and short-lived. Learning to overcome imaginative doubt. Picture the following. You are led into a room with a table. On the table are three items, a box of tacks, a book of matches, and a candle. You are told that you have only one assignment. Attach the candle to the wall. You can take as much time as you need. How do you proceed? If you are like over 75% of the participants in the now classic study by the Gestalt psychologist Carl Duncker, you would likely try one of two routes. You might try to tack the candle onto the wall, but you'll quickly find that method to be futile. Or you might try to light the candle and use the dripping wax to attach it to the wall, foregoing the box of tacks entirely. After all, you might think, it could be a distractor. Again, you'd fail. The wax is not strong enough to hold the candle, and your contraption will collapse. What now? For the real solution, you need some imagination. No one sees it at once. Some people find it after only a minute or two of thought. Others see it after faltering through several unsuccessful attempts, and others fail to solve it without some outside help. Here's the answer. Take the tacks out of the box. Tack the box to the wall and light the candle. Soften the bottom of the candle with a match so that the wax begins to drip into the box, and place the candle inside the box on top of the soft pillow of wax. Secure. Run out of the room before the candle burns low enough to set the box on fire. Voila! Why don't so many people see that alternative? They forget that between observation and deduction, there lies an important mental moment. They take the hot System Watson route, action, 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 underestimating the crucial need for the exact opposite, a moment of quiet reflection. And so they understandably go at once for the most natural or most obvious solutions. The majority of people in this situation do not see that something obvious, a box of tacks, might actually be something less obvious, a box and tacks. This is known as functional fixedness. We tend to see objects the way they are presented, as serving a specific function that is already assigned. The box and tacks go together as a box of tacks. The box holds the tacks. It does not have another function. To go past that and actually break the object into two component parts, to realize that the box and matches are two different things, takes an imaginative leap. Dunker, coming from the Gestalt School, was studying precisely this question of our tendency to see the whole over the parts. Indeed, in follow-ups to Dunker's original study, one experiment showed that if the objects were presented separately, with the tacks sitting beside the box, the percentage of people who solved the problem rose dramatically. Ditto with a simple linguistic tweak. If participants were primed, prior to encountering the candle problem, with a series of words connected with and instead of, as in a box and tacks, they were much more likely to see the solution. And even if the words were just underlined separately as five items, candle, book, of, matches, and box, of, tacks, participants were also much more likely to solve the problem. But the original problem requires some thought, a shift away from the obvious without any external help. It's not as simple as looking at everything you've observed and right away acting or trying to deduce the most likely scenario that would satisfy your objective. Those people who were able to solve it knew the importance of not acting, the value of letting their minds take the situation in and give it some internal, quiet thought. In short, they realized that between observation and deduction lies the crucial, irreplaceable step of imagination. It's easy to see Sherlock Holmes as a hard, cold reasoning machine, the epitome of calculating logic. But that view of Holmes, the logical automaton, couldn't be further from the truth. Quite the contrary. What makes Holmes who he is, what places him above detectives, inspectors, and civilians alike, is his willingness to engage in the nonlinear, embrace the hypothetical, entertain the conjecture. It's his capacity for creative thought and imaginative reflection. Why, then, do we tend to miss this softer, almost artistic side and focus instead on the detective's computer-like powers of rational calculation? Simply put, that view is both easier and safer. It is a line of thinking that is well ingrained into our psychology. We have been trained to do it from an early age. As Albert Einstein put it, "Certainly we should take care not to make the intellect our god. It has, of course, powerful muscles, but no personality. It cannot lead, it can only serve, and it is not fastidious in its choice of a leader." We live in a society that glorifies the computer model, that idolizes the inhuman Holmes, who can take in countless data points as a matter of course, analyze them with startling precision, and spit out a solution. a society that gives short shrift to the power of something as unquantifiable as imagination, and focuses instead on the power of the intellect. But wait, you might think, that's completely bogus. We also thrive on the idea of innovation and creativity. We are living in the age of the entrepreneur, of the man of ideas, of Steve Jobs, and the think different motto. Well, yes and no. That is, we value creativity on the surface, but in our heart of hearts, imagination can scare us like crazy. As a general rule, we dislike uncertainty. It makes us uneasy. A certain world is a much friendlier place. And so we work hard to reduce whatever uncertainty we can, often by making habitual, practical choices which protect the status quo. You know the saying, better the devil you know. That about sums it up. Creativity, on the other hand, requires novelty. Imagination is all about new possibilities, eventualities that don't exist, counterfactuals, a recombination of elements in new ways. It is about the untested. And the untested is uncertain. It is frightening, even if we aren't aware of just how much it frightens us personally. It is also potentially embarrassing. After all, there's never a guarantee of success. Why do you think Conan Doyle's inspectors are always so loath to depart from standard protocol, to do anything that might in the least endanger their investigation or delay it by even an instant? Holmes's imagination frightens them. Consider a common paradox. Organizations, institutions, and individual decision-makers often reject creative ideas, even as they state openly that creativity is an important and sometimes central goal. Why? New research suggests that we may hold an unconscious bias against creative ideas, much like we do in cases of racism or phobias. Remember the implicit association test from Chapter 2? In a series of studies, Jennifer Mueller and colleagues decided to modify it for something that had never appeared in need of testing. Creativity. Participants had to complete the same good-bad category pairing as in the standard IAT. Only this time, with two words that expressed an attitude that was either practical, functional, constructive, or useful, or creative, novel, inventive, or original. The result indicated that even those people who had explicitly ranked creativity as high on their list of positive attributes showed an implicit bias against it relative to practicality under conditions of uncertainty. And what's more, they also rated an idea that had been pre-tested as creative. For example, a running shoe that uses nanotechnology to adjust fabric thickness to cool the foot and reduce blisters, as less creative than their more certain counterparts. So not only were they implicitly biased, but they exhibited a failure to see creativity for what it was when directly faced with it. True, that effect was seen only in uncertain conditions, but doesn't that describe most decision-making environments? It certainly applies to detective work, and corporations, and science, and business, and basically anything else you can think of. Great thinkers have gotten over that hump, that fear of the void. Einstein had failures. So did Abraham Lincoln, probably one of the few men to go to war a captain and return a private, and to file twice for bankruptcy before assuming the presidency. So did Walt Disney, getting fired from a newspaper for lack of imagination. The creativity paradox, if there ever was one, in full force. So did Thomas Edison, inventing over 1,000 failed specimens before he came up with a light bulb that worked. And so did Sherlock Holmes. Irene Adler, anyone? Man with the Twisted Lip? Or how about that yellow face, to which we'll soon return in greater detail? What distinguishes them isn't a lack of failure, but a lack of fear of failure, an openness that is the hallmark of the creative mind. They may have had that same anti-creative bias as most of us at one point in their lives, but one way or another, they managed to squelch it into submission. Sherlock Holmes has one element that a computer lacks, and it is that very element that both makes him what he is and undercuts the image of the detective as nothing more than a logician par excellence. Imagination. Who hasn't dismissed a problem because no obvious answer presented itself at once? And which of us hasn't made a wrong decision or taken a wrong turn because we never stopped to think that clear and obvious might be a trifle too obvious? Who hasn't persisted in a less than ideal setup just because that's the way things were always done? And though better ways may exist, they would depart too much from the tried and true. Better the devil you know. Our fear of uncertainty keeps us in check when we'd do better to accompany Holmes on one of his imaginative wanderings and play out scenarios that may exist, for the time being at least, only in our heads. Einstein, for one, had nothing but intuition to go on when he proposed his grand theory of general relativity. When George Sylvester Viereck asked him, in 1929, whether his discoveries were the result of intuition or inspiration, Einstein replied, "I'm enough of an artist to draw freely on my imagination, which I think is more important than knowledge. Knowledge is limited. Imagination encircles the world." Absent imagination, the great scientist would have been stuck in the certainty of the linear and the easily accessible. What's more, many problems don't even have an obvious answer to turn to. In the case of our Norwood mystery, Lestrade had a ready-made story in suspect. But what if that didn't exist? What if there was no linear narrative, and the only way to get to the answer was by circuitous and hypothetical meanderings of the mind? One such case appears in The Valley of Fear, when the victim isn't at all who he seems to be, and neither is the house. A lack of imagination in that instance equals a lack of solution. And in a world far removed from detectives and inspectors and builders, what if there's no obvious job path or better romantic prospect or choice that would make us happier? What if the answer instead requires digging and some creative self-exploration? Not many would change a known devil for an unknown one, and fewer still would exchange it for none at all. Without imagination, we would never be able to reach the heights of thought that we are capable of. We'd be doomed, at the very best, to become very good at spewing back details and facts, but would find it difficult to use those facts in any way that could meaningfully improve our judgment and decision-making. We'd have an attic stacked with beautifully organized boxes, folders, and materials, and we wouldn't know where to begin to go through them all. Instead, we'd have to thumb through the stacks over and over, maybe finding the right approach, maybe not. And if the right element wasn't there for the taking, but had to actually come from two or even three different files, good luck to us. Let's go back for a moment to the case of the Norwood builder. Why is that, lacking imagination, Lestrade can't come near solving the mystery, and indeed comes close to sentencing an innocent man? What does imagination provide here that straightforward analysis does not? Both the inspector and the detective have access to identical information. Holmes doesn't have some secret knowledge that would enable him to see something that Lestrade does not, or at least any knowledge that Lestrade, too, couldn't easily apply in much the same fashion. But not only do the two men choose to use different elements of their shared knowledge, they then interpret what they do know in altogether different lights. Lestrade follows the straightforward approach, and Sherlock a more imaginative one that the inspector does not even conceive to be possible. At the beginning of the investigation, Holmes and Lestrade start from the exact same point as John Hector MacFarlane gives the entirety of his statement in their joint presence. In fact, it's Lestrade who has an edge of a sort. He has already been to the scene of the crime, while Holmes is only now hearing of it for the first time. And yet, right away, their approaches diverge. When Lestrade, prior to arresting MacFarlane and leading him away, asks Holmes whether he has any further questions, Holmes replies, "Not until I have been to Blackheath." "Blackheath? But the murder took place in Norwood."
"You mean Norwood,"
Lestrade corrects the detective.
"Oh yes, no doubt that is what I must have meant," replies Holmes, and proceeds, of course, to Blackheath, the home of the unfortunate Mr. MacFarlane's parents.
"And why not Norwood?" asks Watson,
just as Lestrade had wondered before him.
"Because," replies Holmes, We have in this case one singular incident coming close to the heels of another singular incident. The police are making the mistake of concentrating their attention upon the second, because it happens to be the one which is actually criminal. Strike one, as you'll see in a moment, against Lestrade's overly straightforward approach. Holmes is disappointed in his trip. "I tried one or two leads," he tells Watson upon his return, "but could get at nothing which would help our hypothesis, and several points which would make against it. I gave up at last, and off I went to Norwood." But as we'll soon see, the time wasn't wasted, nor does Holmes think it was. For you never know how the most straightforward-seeming events will unfold once you use that attic space of imagination to its fullest potential. And you never know just what piece of information will make a nonsensical puzzle all of a sudden make sense. Still, the case does not seem to be heading toward a successful resolution. As Holmes tells Watson, "Unless some lucky chance comes our way, I fear that the Norwood disappearance case will not figure in that chronicle of our successes, which I foresee that a patient public will sooner or later have to endure." And then, from the most unlikely of places, that very lucky chance appears. Lestrade calls it important fresh evidence that definitively establishes McFarlane's guilt. Holmes is stricken until he realizes just what that fresh evidence is. McFarlane's bloody fingerprint on the hallway wall. What to Lestrade is proof positive of guilt, to Holmes is the very epitome of McFarlane's innocence. And what's more, it confirms a suspicion that has, to that point, been nothing more than a nagging feeling, an intuition, as Holmes calls it, that there has been no crime to begin with. Jonas Oldacre is, as a matter of fact, alive and well. How can that be? How can the exact same piece of information serve for the inspector to condemn a man, and for Holmes to free him, and to cast doubt on the nature of the entire crime? It all comes down to imagination. Let's go through it step by step. First off, there's Holmes's initial response to the story. Not to rush immediately to the scene of the supposed crime, but rather to acquaint himself with all possible angles, which may or may not prove useful. And so, a trip to Blackheath, to those very parents who are supposed to have known Jonas Oldacre when young, and who, of course, know McFarlane. While this may not seem to be particularly imaginative, it does entail a more open-minded and less linear approach than the one espoused by Lestrade. Straight to the scene of the crime, and the scene of the crime only. Lestrade has, in a way, closed off all alternate possibilities from the get-go. Why bother to look if everything you need is right in one place? Much of imagination is about making connections that are not entirely obvious, between elements that may appear disparate at first. When I was younger, my parents gave me a toy of sorts, a wooden pole with a hole in the middle and a ring at the base. Through the hole was threaded a thick string with two wooden circles on either end. The point of the toy was to get the ring off the pole. It seemed like a piece of cake at first, until I realized that the string with its circles prevented the ring from coming off the obvious way, over the top of the pole. I tried force, and more force, and speed. Maybe I could trick it. I tried to get the string and circles to somehow detach, the ring to slide over the circles that it hadn't slid over in the past. Nothing worked. None of the solutions that seemed most promising were actually solutions at all. Instead, to remove the ring, you had to take a path so circuitous that it took me hours of trying, with days in between, to finally have the patience to reach it. For you had to, in a sense, stop trying to take the ring off. I'd always begun with that ring, thinking that it had to be the right way to go. After all, wasn't the whole point to remove it? It wasn't until I forgot the ring and took a step back to look at the overall picture and to explore its possibilities that I came upon the solution. I, too, had to go to Blackheath before I could figure out what was going on in Norwood. Unlike Lestrade, I had a strict guide. I would know when I had solved the puzzle correctly, and so I didn't need Holmes's nudging. I realized I was wrong because I would know without a doubt when I was right. But most problems aren't so clear-cut. There's no stubborn ring that gives you only two answers, right and wrong. Instead, there's a whole mass of misleading turns and false resolutions. And absent Holmes's reminder, you may be tempted to keep tugging at that ring to get it off and think that it has been removed, when all you've really done is lodged it farther up the pole. So, Holmes goes to Blackheath. But that's not the end to his willingness to engage in the imaginative. In order to approach the case of the Norwood Builder as the detective does and accomplish what he accomplishes, you need to begin from a place of open-minded possibility. You cannot equate the most obvious course of events with the only possible course of events. If you do so, you run the risk of never even thinking of any number of possibilities that may end up being the real answer. And, more likely than not, you will fall prey to that nasty confirmation bias that we've seen in play in previous chapters. In this instance, not only does Holmes hold very real the chance that McFarlane is innocent, but he maintains and plays out a number of hypothetical scenarios that exist only in his mind, whereby each piece of evidence, including the central one of the very death of the builder, is not what it appears to be. In order to realize the true course of events, Holmes must first imagine the possibility of that course of events. Otherwise, he'd be like Lestrade, left saying, "I don't know whether you think that McFarlane came out of jail in the dead of the night in order to strengthen the evidence against himself," and following up that seemingly rhetorical statement with, "I am a practical man, Mr. Holmes, and when I have got my evidence, I come to my conclusions." Lestrade's rhetorical certainty is so misplaced precisely because he is a practical man who goes straight from evidence to conclusions. He forgets that crucial step in between, that space that gives you time to reflect, to think of other possibilities, to consider what may have occurred, and to follow those hypothetical lines out inside your mind, instead of being forced to use only what is in front of you. But never underestimate the crucial importance of that observational stage that has come before, the filling up of the staging area with pieces of information for your use. Holmes can come to his conclusions about the thumbprint only because he knows that he did not miss it before. "I know that that mark was not there when I examined the hall yesterday," he tells Watson. He trusts in his observations, in his attention, in the essential soundness of his attic and its contents both. Lestrade, lacking his training and ruled as he is by System Watson, knows no such certainty. A lack of imagination can thus lead to faulty action, the arrest or suspicion of the wrong man, and to the lack of proper action, looking for the actual culprit. If only the most obvious solution is sought, the correct one may never be found at all. Reason without imagination is akin to System Watson at the controls. It seems to make sense, and it's what we want to do, but it's too impulsive and quick. You cannot possibly assess and see the whole picture, even if the solution ends up being rather prosaic, if you don't take a step back to let imagination have its say. Consider this counterexample to the conduct of Lestrade. In The Adventure of Wisteria Lodge, Holmes pays one of his rare compliments to Inspector Baines. "You will rise high in your profession. You have instinct and intuition." What does Baines do differently from his Scotland Yard counterparts to earn such praise? He anticipates human nature instead of dismissing it, arresting the wrong man on purpose with the goal of lulling the real criminal into false complacency. The wrong man, of course, has a preponderance of evidence against him, more than enough for an arrest, and to a Lestrade would seem to be the right man. In fact, Holmes initially mistakes Baines' arrest as nothing more than a Lestrade-like blunder. And in this anticipation lies one of the main virtues of an imaginative approach, going beyond simple logic in interpreting facts and instead using that same logic to create hypothetical alternatives. A Lestrade would never think to do something so nonlinear. Why in the world expend the energy to arrest someone if that someone is not who should be arrested according to the law? Lacking imagination, he can think only in a straight line. In 1968, the high jump was a well-established sport. You would run, you would jump, and you would make your way over a pole in one of several ways. In older days, you'd likely use the scissors, scissoring out your legs as you glided over. But by the 60s, you'd probably be using the straddle or the belly roll, facing down and basically rolling over the bar. Whichever style you used, one thing was certain. You'd be facing forward when you made your jump. Imagine trying to jump backward. That would be ridiculous. Dick Fosbury, however, didn't think so. To him, jumping backward seemed like the way to go. All through high school, he'd been developing a backward-facing style, and now in college, it was taking him higher than it ever had. He wasn't sure why he did it, but if he thought about it, he would say that his inspiration came from the East, from Confucius and Lao Tzu. He didn't care what anyone else was doing. He just jumped with the feeling of the thing. People joked and laughed. Fosbury looked just as ridiculous as they thought he would. And his inspirations sounded a bit ridiculous, too. When asked about his approach, he told Sports Illustrated, "I don't even think about the high jump. It's positive thinking. I just let it happen." Certainly, no one expected him to make the U.S. Olympics team, let alone win the Olympics. But win he did, setting American and Olympic records with his 7-foot, 4.25-inch, 2.24-meter jump, only 1.5 inches short of the world record. With his unprecedented technique, dubbed the Fosbury Flop, Fosbury did what many other more traditional athletes had never managed to accomplish. He revolutionized, in a very real way, an entire sport. Even after his win, expectations were that he would remain a lone bird, jumping in his esoteric style, while the rest of the world looked on. But since 1978, no world record has been set by anyone other than a flopper. And by 1980, 13 of 16 Olympic finalists were flopping across the bar. To this day, the flop remains the dominant high jump style. The straddle looks old and cumbersome in comparison. Why hadn't anyone thought of replacing it earlier? Of course, everything seems intuitive in retrospect. But what seems perfectly clear now was completely inventive and unprecedented at the time. No one thought you could possibly jump backward. It seemed absurd. And Fosbury himself? He wasn't even a particularly talented jumper. As his coach, Bernie Wagner, put it, "I have a discus thrower who can jump reach higher than Dick." It was all in the approach. Indeed, Fosbury's height pales in comparison to the current record, 8 feet, 2.45 meters, held by Javier Sotomayor, and his accomplishment doesn't even break the top 20. But the sport has never been the same. Imagination allows us to see things that aren't so, be it a dead man who is actually alive. A way of jumping that, while backward, couldn't be more forward-looking. Or a box of tacks that can also be a simple box. It lets us see what might have been and what might be, even in the absence of firm evidence. When all of the details are in front of you, how do you arrange them? How do you know which are important? Simple logic gets you part of the way there, it's true, but it can't do it alone. And it can't do it without some breathing space. In our resistance to creativity, we are Lestrades. But here's the good news. Our inner homes isn't too far away. Our implicit bias may be strong, but it's not immutable, and it doesn't need to affect our thinking as much as it does. Look at the following picture. One row of two dots, and a second row of two dots. Try to connect these dots with three lines without lifting your pencil from the paper or retracing any of the lines you drew. You must also end the drawing where you began it. You can take up to 3 minutes. Have you finished? If you haven't, fear not. You're far from being alone. In fact, you're like 78% of study participants who were given the problem to solve. If you have, how long did it take you? Consider this. If I had turned on a light bulb in your line of sight while you were working on the problem, you would have been more likely to solve it if you hadn't solved it already. A full 44% of people who saw a lit light bulb solved the puzzle, as contrasted with the 22% in the original condition, the one that you just experienced. And you would have solved it faster than you might have otherwise. The bulb will have activated insight-related concepts in your mind, and in so doing, will have primed your mind to think in a more creative fashion than it would as a matter of course. It is an example of priming in action. Because we associate the light bulb with creativity and insight, we are more likely to persist at difficult problems and to think in a creative, nonlinear fashion when we see it turn on. All of the concepts that are stored in our attic next to the idea of light bulb moment, or insight, or eureka, become activated. And that activation, in turn, helps us become more creative in our own approaches. By the way, here's the solution to the dot problem. Connect the first two dots and extend the line out to the right. Then take that line and extend it down through the lower right dot, and extend it even farther down. And then extend it upward through the two dots to the first dot in the first row. Our natural mindset may well be holding us back, but a simple prime is enough to cue it in a very different direction indeed. And it need not be a light bulb. Works of art on the walls do the trick too. The color blue. Pictures of famous creative thinkers. Happy faces. Happy music. In fact, almost all positive cues. Plants and flowers and scenes of nature. All of these tend to boost our creativity with or without our awareness. That's cause for celebration. Whatever the stimulus, as soon as your mind begins to reflect on the idea, you become more likely to embody that very idea. There are even studies that show that wearing a white coat will make you more likely to think in scientific terms and be better at solving problems. The coat likely activates the concept of researchers and doctors, and you begin to take on the characteristics you associate with those people. But short of lighting bulbs in our blue room with portraits of Einstein and Jobs on the walls while listening to happy music, wearing a white coat, and watering our beautiful roses, how can we best make our way to Holmes' capacity for imaginative thinking? The importance of distance. One of the most important ways to facilitate imaginative thinking, to make sure that we don't move, like Lestrade, straight from evidence to conclusion, is through distance in multiple senses of the word. In The Adventure of the Bruce Partington Plans, a case that comes quite late in the Holmes-Watson partnership, Watson observes, "One of the most remarkable characteristics of Sherlock Holmes was his power of throwing his brain out of action and switching all his thoughts on to lighter things whenever he had convinced himself that he could no longer work to advantage. I remember that during the whole of that memorable day, he lost himself in a monograph which he had undertaken upon the polyphonic motets of Lassus. For my own part, I had none of this power of detachment, and the day, in consequence, appeared to be interminable." Forcing your mind to take a step back is a tough thing to do. It seems counterintuitive to walk away from a problem that you want to solve. But in reality, the characteristic is not so remarkable, either for Holmes or for individuals who are deep thinkers. The fact that it is remarkable for Watson, and that he self-admittedly lacks the skill, goes a long way to explaining why he so often fails when Holmes succeeds. Psychologist Yakov Trope argues that psychological distance may be one of the single most important steps you can take to improve thinking and decision-making. It can come in many forms, temporal, or distance in time, both future and past, spatial, or distance in space, how physically close or far you are from something, social, or distance between people, how someone else sees it, and hypothetical, or distance from reality, how things might have happened. But whatever the form, all of these distances have something in common. They all require you to transcend the immediate moment in your mind. They all require you to take a step back. Trope posits that the further we move in distance, the more general and abstract our perspective and our interpretation become. And the further we move from our own perspective, the wider the picture we are able to consider. Conversely, as we move closer once more, our thoughts become more concrete, more specific, more practical, and the closer we remain to our egocentric view, the smaller and more limited the picture that confronts us. Our level of constructual influences, in turn, how we evaluate a situation and how we ultimately choose to interact with it. It affects our decisions and our ability to solve problems. It even changes how our brains process information on a neural level. Specifically, it tends to engage our prefrontal cortex and medial temporal lobe. More on that later. In essence, psychological distance accomplishes one major thing. It engages system homes. It forces quiet reflection. Distancing has been shown to improve cognitive performance, from actual problem-solving to the ability to exercise self-control. Children who use psychological distancing techniques, for example, visualizing marshmallows as puffy clouds, a technique we'll discuss more in the next section, are better able to delay gratification and hold out for a larger later reward. Adults who are told to take a step back and imagine a situation from a more general perspective make better judgments and evaluations and have better self-assessments and lower emotional reactivity. Individuals who employ distancing in typical problem-solving scenarios emerge ahead of their more immersed counterparts. And those who take a distanced view of political questions tend to emerge with evaluations that are better able to stand the test of time. You can think of the exercise as a large, complicated puzzle. The box has been lost, so you don't know what exactly you're putting together. And pieces from other similar puzzles have gotten mixed in over the years, so you're not even sure which pieces belong. To solve the puzzle, you must first have a sense of the picture as a whole. Some pieces will jump out right away. The corners, the edges, the colors, and patterns that obviously go together. And before you know it, you have a clearer sense of where the puzzle is heading and where and how the remaining pieces should fit. But you'll never solve it if you don't take the time to lay the pieces out properly. Identify those telling starter moves and try to form an image in your mind of the complete picture. Trying to force individual pieces at random will take forever, cause needless frustration, and perhaps lead to your never being able to solve the thing at all. You need to learn to let the two elements, the concrete, specific pieces, their details and colors, what they tell you and what they suggest, and the broad overall picture, the general impression that gives you a sense of the tableau as a whole, work together to help you put the puzzle together. Both are essential. The pieces have been gathered already through close observation. Seeing how they fit can be accomplished only by the distance of imagination. It can be any of trope's distances, temporal, spatial, social, or hypothetical. But distance, it must be. When I was little, I used to love yes or no riddle games. One person holds the answer to a simple riddle. One of my favorites as a child, Joe and Mandy are lying on the floor, dead. Around them are broken glass, a pool of water, and a baseball. What happened? The rest try to guess the solution by asking questions that require only a yes or no answer. I could play these for hours and forced many a hapless companion to share the somewhat strange pastime. Back then, I didn't see the riddles as much more than a fun way to pass the time and test my detective prowess. And part of the reason I loved them was because they made me feel up to the task. Only now do I understand fully how ingenious that forced question method really is. It forces you to separate observation from deduction, whether you want to or not. In a way, the riddles have a built-in roadmap for how to get to the solution. Incrementally, taking frequent breaks to let your imagination consolidate and reform what it has learned. You can't just barrel on through. You observe, you learn, and you take the time to consider the possibilities. Look at the angles. Try to place the elements in their proper context. See if you might have come to a mistaken conclusion at an earlier point. The yes or no riddle forces imaginative distance. The solution to Joe and Mandy's dilemma? They are goldfish. The baseball flew in through a window and broke their bowl. But absent such an inbuilt cue, how does one go about creating distance? How can one resist Watson's lack of detachment and be able, like Holmes, to know when and how to throw his brain out of action and turn it to lighter things? As it happens, even something as seemingly inborn as creativity and imagination can be broken down into steps that traverse that very you have it or you don't divide. Distancing through unrelated activity. What, pray tell, is a three-pipe problem? It certainly doesn't make it on the list of common problem types in the psychology literature, and yet, perhaps it's time it should. In The Red-Headed League, Sherlock Holmes is presented with an unusual conundrum, which at first glance has no reasonable solution. Why in the world would someone be singled out for the color of his hair, and then be paid to do nothing but sit around, along with the hair in question, in a closed room for hours on end? When Mr. Wilson, the man of the flaming red hair, leaves Holmes after telling his story, Holmes tells Watson that he must give his prompt attention to the matter. "What are you going to do, then?" asks Watson, anxious as ever to know how the case will be resolved. Holmes's reply may come as somewhat of a surprise. "To smoke," he answered. "It is quite a three-pipe problem, and I beg that you won't speak to me for 50 minutes. He curled himself up in his chair, with his thick knees drawn up to his hawk-like nose, and there he sat with his eyes closed and his black clay pipe thrusting out like the bill of some strange bird. I had come to the conclusion that he had dropped asleep, and indeed was nodding myself, when he suddenly sprang out of his chair with the gesture of a man who has made up his mind, and put his pipe down upon the mantelpiece. A three-pipe problem, then. One that requires doing something other than thinking directly about the problem, that is, smoking a pipe, in concentrated silence, and one expects smoke, for the time that it takes to smoke three pipes. Presumably, one of a subset of problems ranging from the single pipe problem to the largest number you can smoke without making yourself sick, and so putting the entire effort to waste. Holmes, of course, means something quite a bit more by his response. For him, the pipe is but a means, and one means of many, to an end. Creating psychological distance between himself and the problem at hand, so that he can let his observations, in this case, what he has learned from the visitor's story and appearance, percolate in his mind, mixing with all of the matter in his brain attic in leisurely fashion, in order to know what the actual next step in the case should be. Watson would have him do something at once, as suggested by his question. Holmes, however, puts a pipe in between himself and the problem. He gives his imagination time to do its thing undisturbed. The pipe is but a means to an end, yes, but it is an important physical means as well. It's significant here that we are dealing with an actual object and an actual activity. A change in activity to something seemingly unrelated to the problem in question is one of the elements that is most conducive to creating the requisite distance for imagination to take hold. Indeed, it is a tactic that Holmes employs often, and to good effect. He smokes his pipe, but he also plays his violin, visits the opera, and listens to music. These are his preferred distancing mechanisms. The precise activity isn't as important as its physical nature and its ability to train your thoughts in a different direction. It needs to have several characteristics. It needs to be unrelated to what you are trying to accomplish. If you are solving a crime, you shouldn't switch to solving another crime. If you are deciding on an important purchase, you shouldn't go shopping for something else, and so on. It needs to be something that doesn't take too much effort on your part. If you're trying to learn a new skill, for instance, your brain will be so preoccupied that it won't be able to free up the resources needed to root through your attic. Holmes's violin playing, unless you are, like him, a virtuoso, you need not apply that particular route. And yet it needs to be something that engages you on some level. If Holmes hated pipe smoking, he would hardly benefit from a three-pipe problem. Likewise, if he found pipe smoking boring, his mind might be too dull to do any real thinking, on whatever level. Or he might find himself unable to detach in the manner that so afflicts Watson.